Welcome, listeners, back to the Saving Delaware History Podcast, and welcome again to today's guest, Paul Naska, the Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs, Curator of Archaeology, here to talk with us about the Division's collection of shipwrecked artifacts. Now, before we get into all the official questions that I want to ask, first, I came across this guy called Dale Clifton in my research, and I just want to know who he is and how he's associated with the state's collections, as it seems he has quite an extensive collection of shipwreck artifacts himself.
Yeah, so Dale Clifton is a he's a hobbyist, more or less. Has devoted his passion of treasure hunting into sort of a pseudo career with operating a museum. So he is somebody who pursues archaeological resources or sort of treasures as a way to fulfill his hobby or his interests in history, but he also looks to sell things. And that's really the big divide between sort of archaeological preservation, where we're more concerned about learning about the past as opposed to finding out, finding monetary value in objects of the past. So that's sort of the divide between what treasure hunting is and sort of what, museum curation is or, museum preservation is. So he has an extensive collection that he exhibits within a museum, but a lot of this stuff is also for sale. So if you have a big pocketbook and you want to purchase some of his finds, you can walk out the door with them. Whereas, you can't walk into a museum and say, oh, I think that's really cool. I'd like to take that home with me.
Yes.
History's a broad tent. Interest in history is a broad tent. Certainly, there is room to work with folks who are more on the treasure hunting side as opposed to the preservation side. There's been a lot of success stories bringing avocationals into the archaeology field to help guide through active research, but also to help hear their voice and knowledge and contribution, because they often are quite knowledgeable about events and materials that they find. So, it's a big tent. History's a big tent. There's room for all of us, I guess. The biggest divide is that certainly the state doesn't look to sell anything, whereas someone like Dale is certainly into it for some monetary profit.
That makes sense. Because I was researching like him, and he seemed to have a lot of the same sort of collections from the Debrack shipwreck and that kind of stuff. And yet he made it clear that he was not associated with the state.
Right. He also calls his place a museum, and they use the word archaeology fairly loosely. It's not archaeology at all. It's a treasure recovery is sort of after. And, it's more of an exhibit space. Like, hi, this is my cool collection that I've dug up. Isn't it grand?
So is it considered archaeology if it's still like under the water?
Sort of the pursuit of archaeology is to learn about the past through the material remains that are left behind. And it's mostly to learn about people as opposed to objects. We want to know what life was like for people of the past and how that story is a Delaware story. And also how does that speak to us as a larger nation and group of colonies before that? It certainly speaks also to the pre-contact period of people here. There's 10,000 years, pushing it to 12, pushing it to as far as 30,000 years of the peopling of North America. So there's this tremendous, deep, rich history of pre-contact people as well that archaeologists encounter. So archaeology is, whether you're recovering artifacts from underwater or from land, archaeology is pretty much the same as if your intent is to learn about the people of the past. If you're only interested in extracting objects for their monetary value, that's treasure hunting. That tends to, you can do that both underwater and above water. The interesting thing about underwater archaeology or treasure hunting is usually when an archaeological site or a site is created. It's usually the result of calamity. So the ship sinks. So when you have a situation like that, the ship sinks, the house burns down, the volcano erupts and buries us, Pompeii. You know, it encapsulates everything. These sites are often very archaeologically rich in objects. Whereas, you know, if we're just living at a site for 20 years and every day we throw our trash out the back window, you get sort of the slow accumulation of stuff that builds up over time. And, you know, we're not throwing out our jewelry and all our gold coins and, all that kind of booty that treasure hunters go for. A lot of archaeology is sort of pretty mundane stuff. Broken pots, just the detritus garbage that sort of builds up as a result of human activity, whereas sort of these glamorous shipwrecks are sort of these instantaneous calamities that sort of, or instances where everything goes down with the ship kind of thing. And, you know, they can be very rich in objects because they capture so much in the event that puts them underwater.
What shipwrecks are kind of around the state of Delaware?
There are many shipwrecks around the state of Delaware. We don't know them all. There have been books published. There's hundreds of shipwrecks throughout the water. So it's the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean coastal waters, the inland bays, as well as the Delaware Bay and River. So we're surrounded by water essentially on two sides. So there's lots of archaeological remains or lots of shipwreck remains. We don't know them all, like I said, and I'm sure, many more are to be discovered. But there are some well-known wreck sites around, the Dubrock being one of them, the Roosevelt Inlet shipwreck is another. Each of those collections are curated here at the state. And then there's bits and pieces of other shipwrecks as well, including one that's called the China Wreck. And it gets its name because it's cargo of ironstone dishes and plates that were coming over from England.
From each of these shipwrecks, how extensive are the division's collections?
So we have dribs and drabs of some smaller ones, like the China Wreck, the Plum Island Wreck. But we have extensive holdings of Dubrock and Roosevelt Inlet shipwreck. So Roosevelt Inlet shipwreck gets its name because it's an unknown ship. We don't know what wreck that is. There was some initial identification as the Severn, which was an English ship that is known to have been lost in the Lewis area. But current research actually thinks it's a different ship, that it's in fact a Dutch merchant vessel bound for Philadelphia called the Johanna Marie. So that's some new current research on that. That's it. But our collections are extensive. The Dubrock being probably the largest collection in archaeology curation with the state.
What was recovered from that shipwreck?
So Dubrock is an interesting story. Dubrock is, the ship itself is an English naval warship. So it's a ship that is on escort duty to see a group of North American merchantmen safely across the Atlantic. And it sinks at this funny time in history. It sinks in the late 1790s at a time period where we're a brand new country and we don't have any real industry here. So we're still very dependent on England and Europe for manufactured goods. We have lots of natural resources here that we're exporting, like lumber and fish and grain to England, but we're importing all these manufactured goods. And at this time, England and France are at war with each other. So American shipping is being harassed on the high seas. And so the United States sort of brokers a deal as part of what's called the Jay Treaty. The treaty has a much longer name, but everybody just sort of calls it the Jay Treaty right now. And it basically says that England will trade pretty much exclusively with you, not with France. But you need to provide some military muscle to guide our ships safely across the Atlantic. And that's how the Dubrock gets here. DeBrock is coming into Lewis to take on water and is caught in a gale and is literally blown over and sinks quite rapidly. And that ship sinks into sort of into history and is sort of forgotten about until like the 1880s, and then sort of a search goes out for the search efforts sort of get underway in the 1880s to look for DeBrock. And nobody finds her until like 100 years later in the 1980s. A treasure hunting firm, group of guys who make a company to go out and look for DeBrock specifically so they can salvage what's on there for their profit. So again, here's that archaeology versus treasure hunting. You know, we're looking to make money off of this. So DeBrock is fabled to have a load of Spanish gold on board because in its passage across the Atlantic with these merchantmen, it takes a Spanish prize. In other words, it captures a Spanish ship, the Xavier. Xavier's cargo was a load of cacao, so what you're going to make chocolate out of, and copper bars. So there's no gold on board. But there's this fable that she's loaded with gold. So this treasure hunting company finds the DeBrock in the 1980s and salvages it. And they basically take everything up, including the hull itself. So it's this tremendous collection of everyday life at sea of the British military. So it's ceramics, it's glass, it's armaments, basically, you know, the cannons from the ship, all of its ammunition, all of the guns, swords, all of the military accoutrements that go along with that. And there's this amazing level of preservation with this as well. So we have fragments of clothing, things as, you know, as simple as sailors' socks and hats that they wore, and fragments of officers' clothing. So this really tremendous level of preservation with this long variety of artifacts. Most of the time, the organic artifacts, things like clothing, or things made of paper, or things made of natural materials like fibers, like rope and stuff like that, all decompose on land. But with DeBrock, we were lucky enough to get a state of preservation where many of those objects didn't fully decompose. So these treasure hunters sort of take all this stuff up. They do find some coinage on board, but remember, this is a military vessel on service. And so there would have been basically a petty cash coin box on board for services. Like I said, she was coming into Lewis to take on water. It would have had to pay for that service to take on that water. So, you know, it sort of has this basically this petty cash account, you know, coinage on board to pay for those services. And so those coins were found, and they made a lot of hay out of them. Like, you know, look at all this stuff we found. But in reality, the collection is quite small when it comes to coinage with DeBrock. Ultimately, the treasure hunting company goes broke, and the state steps in and purchases the whole collection, including the hull. So that's how we came to own DeBrock. This was strictly a treasure hunting ordeal that sort of went bad in the end, as most of them do. And so the state stepped in to preserve that history for all of us Delawareans.
So where does that collection reside now? Is it in one of our museums?
So good question. So DeBrock is a huge collection. It's about 20,000 objects. Most of those objects are here in curations in Dover. A portion of those objects are on display at the Zwanendael Museum, as well as the Lewis Historical Society. So this is very much a Lewis story and very much a part of sort of the maritime heritage of these coastal communities. But the majority of the collection, like I said, is here in Dover, as well as the hull itself is in a curatorial facility at Cape Henlopen State Park. It's awaiting conservation. We're still looking to conserve the hull. In the fact that it's been raised up and taken out of the water, you know, it's been 30 plus years now. So this is sort of an ongoing thing that we need to sort of tie up these loose ends with DeBrock. So it's keeping that hull fragment wet all the time.
Why is it important to keep it wet all the time?
So organic materials like the wood of the ship, because it has been waterlogged, wood is made up of a bunch of cells, and in those cells is air, and that's why wood floats. When wood becomes waterlogged, water fills those cells, and then the wood sinks. when you take that water back out of those cells, they begin to collapse now because the integrity isn't there anymore. So if we can keep it wet and keep the water in there, it helps support and give mass to that wooden structure. All those tiny little millions and millions of tiny cells that are filled with water still retains the integrity in the shape. If we take all that water out, it's going to start collapsing on itself. So that's the importance of keeping wood wet. Other organic materials are very similar. Things like rope fragments, which is a fibrous material. We also have some iron that is in wet storage. Iron and salt don't get along really well. If you like a car from up in the Northeast that gets sees a lot of winters and the salt on the road, they're all rusted out. So there's a chemical reaction that goes on between iron and salt. We keep a lot of iron objects wet to help pull the salts out of it all the time. And then there's a conservation process that needs to continue after that to stabilize the iron. Because as an iron object rusts, it's in a process of breaking back down into simpler elements. It's actually an organic material. So it decomposes just like a piece of wood or, something that's organic. It decomposes through the process of rusting. So it gives up its ions. It's a chemical thing. So there's lots of iron objects that are still kept wet.
And all these objects that are preserved in water right now, does the state have the capacity to take them out and begin preserving them? Or is that sort of like a niche specialist thing?
Yeah, so that is a niche thing, definitely. And we need to contract that out. The state does not have archaeological conservation laboratory. Here, some states do. Delaware does not. But we contract that out. There's some really great facilities very close by states, such as Maryland. It's, it all just boils down to finding the available monies to pay for that conservation.
You also mentioned the Roosevelt Inlet shipwreck, which we didn't know what specific boat it was. What was recovered from that?
So the Roosevelt Inlet shipwreck is a little bit different. So this was a shipwreck that was encountered during dredging. So they were doing a beach replenishment project in Lewis where they would suck up sand offshore and then pump it back onto the beach. So this is an Army Corps of Engineers doing this project, contracting out to the dredging company. In the process of dredging, they struck an unknown shipwreck. And as they deposited that sand on the beach, beach goers were finding these objects, finding 18th century artifacts. And word got out pretty quickly that these objects were being recovered. And the state archaeologists were informed of it. So in that situation, it's a lot of cargo artifacts, things bound for Philadelphia. So lots of different types of ceramic wares are on board there. Gaming pieces, so lots of interesting metal like toys. There's also lots of glass bottles and ceramic bottles, jugs. This particular ship that we think it is now, in fact, its primary cargo was called Geneva, which is another name, a European name for gin. So it had a large cargo of gin, the intoxicant gin bound for Philadelphia. So in that case, there are no ship's timbers like the hull that was raised up, like the Debras. So this is pretty much just a cargo material. So there's sort of two collections from this. There's the stuff that was gathered from the beach that was displaced from the original site, and then archaeological endeavor was initiated where underwater archaeologists actually did controlled excavation underwater, where they would map out squares on the ocean floor and actually excavate those areas. A similar type of technique that you would use on land.
And did we ever get the hull of that shipwreck out of the water?
We did not. There are bits and pieces. They think there are still more structural pieces there. But there wasn't exactly a full hull segment identified. What's interesting, this new vessel, through research that we think it is, the Ohana Marie, research indicates that this vessel was crushed in ice. It was a very icy winter because of an Icelandic volcano that erupted and spewed a bunch of stuff up into the atmosphere and made things very cold, so much so that it iced up the Delaware and the Delaware Bay. And this vessel was crushed in the ice, spilling its cargo in that instance. So then that's what we think the Roosevelt Inlet shipwreck is sort of this spilled cargo, as opposed to like, oops, the ship blew over and sank in one spot. It was this piles of stuff that sort of was spilled out of the hull.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I read online that the state is no longer accepting more artifacts or collections from people who pick stuff up off the beach. Why is that?
That's right. So our holdings are pretty extensive, and it's a lot of the same types of objects. You know, we have, you know, the exact number is unknown at this point, but somewhere in the neighborhood of 100,000 plus objects. And so much of it is bits and pieces. And that's what folks tend to find most, are sort of these small bits and pieces of stuff. And so oftentimes we'll look at things, but a lot of it is stuff that we already have in curation and we don't really need any more of it. We're always interested in seeing people's collections. We're always interested in documenting what they have. If they do have something really unique, we may consider, you know, approaching them for donation, but it's been quite some time since we took in objects from Roosevelt Inlet shipwreck. I'll be honest with you, you can still go to the beach today and find stuff, and many, many people do. It's an interesting chapter in history. What they're finding are all displaced from the original location. So, you know, just think how much ocean activity there is at a beach. You know, nothing's in its original place, and archaeologists are often very interested in finding things in their original location so we can learn about the site as well as the people that used it.
When you were picking up a lot of these, right when you first discovered these shipwrecks, how could you recognize what was, say, like a glass bottle versus a pair of eyeglasses or some other sort of glass? How can you recognize stuff after they've been so long underwater?
So, good question. It's, as an archaeologist, you get really good at identifying things from the bits and pieces that are left behind. Well, here's an example from my personal well-being. So, I was running once and stepped wrong on something and rotated my ankle and broke a bone in my foot. Went to the hospital, took an x-ray. It hurt like the dickens. The doctor came in and put the x-ray up on the screen and showed it to me. I was like, oh, great, no broken bones. Like, oh, no. And then he showed me the broken bone in my foot. And that's how it is with archaeologists. Now, it's, we may pick up a piece of glass that some folks without the training might just think is a piece of glass, whereas an archaeologist will look at it and say, oh, that's a glass from this type of bottle, or this is a type of glass that dates to this period, or this is a type of glass that was from a pair of eyeglasses. It's just, you just learn the material that, you know, that's your specialty. So it comes with training.
Who exactly does that? So when the division takes in items, how do you sort them out and decide what goes on display and what doesn't?
First of all, there's sort of a couple layers there. When we visit collections or folks ask, you know, can you come look at my collection for me? It's usually myself as the archaeological curator. I'm primarily an archaeologist by training. So I'll go down and evaluate a collection, have a look at it. Is there anything that's very rare here? Is there anything that is not represented in our collection? And then how do we determine what comes in? Is based on my recommendation. It goes up to a collections committee. The collections committee asks lots of questions about this. You know, how does it fit into our collection? Is it worthy of being curated at the expense of the taxpayer? And how will it be used in the future? What I mean by how will it be used in the future is, do we have plans for exhibition of it? Can it be used as an interpretive tool in a museum display? And that's often the hardest question. You know, we might want to save everything, every bit and tiny piece of history, but if we're never going to be able to put it out on display or use it for public interpretation, it's sort of like, well, you know, do we really need to keep it? And do we really need to pay for its storage, conservation, and long-term care forever? Because once an object pretty much comes in, particularly archaeological collections, once archaeological collections come into state curation, they will remain in state curation forever. So So how do we anticipate on what's going to go out on display? You know, we don't always have a crystal ball and, you know what type of research questions there might be or what public interest might be in something. But we always try to keep a good representative example of all of the types of materials, like in the Roosevelt Inlet shipwreck. We have a really good collection of just about all the different artifact types that have been recovered, both in the controlled excavations as well as the beach finds. And so that's why we don't need any more from the public. So it's a multi-step process, and the hardest part is to interpret or understand what's going to go out on display, and then find a location to put it out on display as well. We're sort of a small state, and we don't have, you know, a centralized state museum. We have lots of historic sites like the Zwanendael Museum.
And in all of the artifacts that you've gone through in your time as an archaeologist in the state of Delaware, what would you say your favorite artifact was?
Those questions are so hard for an archaeologist. There's so many compelling objects in the collection. Some objects that are on display on loan to the Lewis Historical Society is the tea service from the Debrock. The tea service is in a type of ceramic called black basalt. It's sort of this jet black ceramic type. It's a stoneware, so it's very refined, very high fired material, and it has a real matte finish to it. It's not glossy like we think of most pieces of ceramic that have a glaze on them. This actually has no glaze. But it's molded in these neoclassical designs of sort of these neoclassical like Grecian women and stuff like that. It sort of invokes this this long history of knowledge and contemplativeness, you know, thinking about life, history, and science. But so this whole tea service was recovered during the salvage project. And, you know, it's broken up and mended back together. But these objects are now on display at the Lewis Historical Society. It's just really cool. This would have been the captain's. Actually, captain is not the right word for him. It would have been Commander James Drew, personal service. So it's a really amazing personalized group of artifacts. So can you imagine taking tea in the captain's quarters? Yeah, I see. It was certainly would have been
a luxury kind of.
Yeah, it was very much a luxury. Drew is lost at sea when Debrock sinks on May 25th, 1798. Owning Drew's tea service, we also have some personal items of his that are very compelling. One is the back of a pocket watch that bears his family crest. Very interesting story. He's contacted by descendants of his family who lived in British Columbia, Canada. And I was contacted by a woman whose brother was getting married. And as a wedding gift, she was going to present him with a gold pocket watch engraved with the same family crest from the artifact. So I supplied her with images of the pocket watch back so it could be reproduced. So a touching, you know, direct link back.
That's wonderful. And wonderful that you get to continue to have that connection with history even today.
Indeed. Very rare do archaeologists get it to that personal level, that individual level. It's very rare. But yeah, these neat connections do happen.
Awesome. Thanks everyone for your time.